This is the BCA Podcast, the outreach arm of Beards Creek Adventures, and your weekly source for all things faith, family, and stewardship. We're your hosts, Charlie and Mike Culkin. Join us each week for interviews, discussions, laughs, and encouragement. We hope you guys enjoy the show.
So welcome back, and we took this week off for New Year's. And now Charlie and I are here, and we're going to talk tonight a little bit about what our goals are going forward for the property. How was Christmas, Charlie?
Good. My Christmas was good. New Year's was good. And as much as all of that went well, I had other excitement that really probably peaked more for the podcast.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Tell us a little about that.
After I don't know how many sits and hours of deer season, the last... second to last hunt I had all season, I finally got on the board.
Yeah. Nothing like waiting until the last minute.
I want to make sure I got the perfect deer.
Did you feel like that was the perfect deer?
Oh, I'm sure she'll taste good.
She's already jerky. Overcooked jerky.
Yeah, I mean, I like it a little on the drier side. I don't want to be chewing on cud.
Yeah, well, that cracked. Like, I could hear it crack when I snapped it in half. Mom... I don't want to throw anybody under the bus, Mom, but that might have gotten a little over.
Well, she was gracious enough to put it on for me while I was at work. So I can't complain. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I would.
So you've been back to work already? Like, you worked between Christmas and New Year's too, right?
Yeah. I only took Christmas Day off and New Year's Day off, and then I had Fridays off otherwise.
And did you shot it? You shot the doe Friday?
Friday afternoon.
Afternoon,
it was
right.
Afternoon, because I didn't hunt Friday morning. I went to ski company.
And I had to leave early, so I didn't help you. I couldn't be out there to field dress or help you get it back or anything. So
no, but I had Kim and Trinity. That was probably the coolest part of the hunt, was I got to bring Trinity in to see her deer get field dressed and the whole process.
Was she squeamish at all?
Not terribly. Kim was getting her to feel the different parts so that way when she gets to mm-hmm. actually field dress one, she knows kind of what to feel for. And
yeah.
And it was nice to have Kim there as well, so she could hold the legs while I was doing it, and then she could talk through to Trinity as I was doing it. It wasn't, we didn't have multiple thoughts going, and
yeah,
so that was cool.
And then you were able to show Kim the right entrance for the butt out.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, I got it. Yep. Which, ironically, was the first time I had got to use it.
Yeah.
I had seen it used before, but we did put it in the right entrance.
So Kim got a doe earlier this year. Early muzzle season, and we haven't done a recap on that hunt yet either, but I had three doe right in front of me, and she shot on the other end of the property, and I'm like, oh, if I take this, then we got two deer down, and when she shot, they all looked up but didn't run. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking, oh my goodness. So I let them walk on, and I got down and then went over and helped her. And so to her defense, no, I can't even defend her. She put it in, couldn't get it. She twisted and couldn't get it out. So then I've got 2 feet on this deer's rump. So I'm sitting on the ground and I'm pushing the deer body away from me, pulling on the, butt out.
Oh my goodness.
It was not, it was comical to say the least.
Yeah.
So you tell us about the hunt, the actual hunt.
So that was, I don't know if I got in late. I got in probably what I was shooting for. It was like maybe 2:30, 3 o'clock that I got in. And it was a weird, I think it was a westward wind.
Yep.
That was kind of an odd spot to sit. And I knew it was either they were going to come out of the bedding where you thought you saw them go that morning.
Yeah.
And I went deep into the field to cut in, so I wasn't disturbing them. And that's kind of where I was expecting. I did see some tracks in the field that made me think maybe they left already going towards Eaton. But I was still hopeful that some were hanging around, or those didn't look terribly fresh. So I was expecting them to come from the east. The wind would be in my favor, and I could maybe make something happen on a doe. And it was maybe a last half hour.
Wait a minute. You were expecting them to come from the east. Because then the wind wouldn't have been in your favor. Wind was coming out of the west.
No, I expected them to come from the west.
West, okay.
Yes. I expected them to come from the west. They came from the east. And it was kind of that last the beginning of the last half hour, 45 minutes. And I remember thinking, all right, it's the last half hour, 45 minutes, putting my phone away. I'm perking up. I was in the act to grab my muzzleloader and kind of like get it situated so that way I was ready. And as I'm putting my phone away, I look up. That's a deer. And that stand, I've had that before where they just kind of emerge from the thicket to the left.
Yeah.
And you don't see them until they're there. And it was kind of wet leaves, so it was quiet. And so now I'm real quietly setting up, and I'm kind of adjusting for my shot. And I could tell that first deer coming out was small. And I think it was that button buck we've had kind of walking around. And so then I'm watching, and there's another one. And I could kind of see there was another one there, and I'm looking. The 4-point was with them. The little spike was with them. And then I kind of got my eyes on one of the bigger doe, and it looked like there was another. It was hard to see. I definitely didn't wait for all of them to come out.
Yeah.
Because I knew that wind, they were right downwind of me. I couldn't believe that they didn't win me in the first place.
Yeah, I can't believe that.
And so I didn't rush the shot. I was able to, there was a shooting bar on that stand, which was nice. I steadied up, and I got my shot off. Well, she kind of ran. She was the only one that ran out into the woods, but with muzzleloader, I didn't see the shot itself. Couldn't see a kick, and was only probably 50% positive that she was the one in the field, the one that I shot. Mm. But as I saw her run off into the field, you could tell like there was that kind of a hip of a step that she wasn't running quite right, and then she was bobbing to the left and to the right, and she wasn't just bolting at a straight path, which was a helpful tip. Yeah, you know, give me a heads up that I actually got a good hit. Well, the 4-point stuck around and stared at me.
Oh, really?
Probably 5 minutes after the shot.
Wow!
I'm actively putting more rounds into my muzzleloader, and I'm like, I dropped my phone, standing up to like get my possibles bag that was hanging to the right, and grab other rounds. I'm putting other rounds in. The little tip of the green, the round,
the star belt
stuck to my not the bottom, the top.
The
point. Stuck to my ramrod. So then I'm kind of messing with that. I was like, I don't need that. It's a close shot if I need it. And I kind of get that. And it saw me like set back up because I didn't know. I wanted to make sure if my deer was still there, I could get a second shot at whatever. If there was another bigger deer, I was prepared.
Yeah.
And the 4-point, which I have seen no less than 50% of my hunts.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is still looking up at me.
It's a wonder that thing's still alive.
I hope it stays this dumb. That's what I'm hoping for. I get a nice 4.5-year-old dumb deer in a couple of years. It's just used to me being there, comes up to say hi because I passed on it the last 3 years.
And then blam.
one of these years, he's going to look too good. Well, he eventually took off in that whole process. I dropped my phone out of the stand. So normally I would wait to check for blood. And muzzleloader is a little, it's not archery, you know, to wait. But once they had taken off and I was pretty sure of that, I was like, all right, I'm going to get down. I'm sure I got a text from either you or Kim, who was hunting down on Butler's property, and let them know, just update them. And then while I was down texting, yes, I shot. My hands are freezing at this point. Forgot hot hands. Mm-hmm. It was windy. And like especially once my hands were out of my pockets and on the right or on the muzzleloader, and then out texting, my hands just got cold.
Yeah.
And so I think my texts were yes.
Yep.
Did you hit it? Yes. Are you gonna track? Yes. I
came out of the woods early because we were going to Emily's to have dinner and meet FJ's parents for the first time. Mm-hmm. And so I was about to get in the shower and I heard the shot. Mm-hmm. And it sounded loud. Like it sounded a lot closer than Boomer's stand is. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I quick texted.
You know. Well, and shortly after, I think I heard Jason across the street shoot. Mm. And it wouldn't surprise me if that group of deer had moved his way, but I don't know. I haven't heard anything from that line. No. So I get down, and I go to check for blood, and where I shot, I found a little bit of hair. And it was, I mean, the exact scenario from when I took my big buck out of that same stand. This stand's facing, it's on a different tree, but same stand, same area. I mean, when I took that big buck, it was just a patch of white hair. It was the same thing with this one. But I knew. I just knew that there was no way. I was so set up. I remember sighting in my muzzleloader. There was just no way. And I start tracking, and there's a little bit of blood. And luckily, the field is soft, so I had some footprints to follow to and a little bit of blood. And then it picked up and I sent a picture that was, okay, there's a bit of a stream of blood, but that blood was a little on the darker side.
Yep.
Well, then I sent a second picture that I think went up onto the Instagram, or at least a story, that was just the clear lung shot bubbly blood. And so at that point I was able to kind of pause. I remember that was the first sign that I stopped and said, thank God I finally, you know, cause there's always that, like, I'm thankful that I got a shot in the first place. But once you know that you got a good hit, that's when I was able to get that relief off my shoulder was this a good hit? So then it was just a matter of finding her. So I texted Kim. She was going to wait a little bit, see if they went her way. She had Trinity with her. And so I start kind of working my way through, and she zigzagged. But the way that field is, I couldn't see past the crest, past where I first saw her run. So I had no idea really how far she went. And I finally, I'm head down, and I kept looking up and head down. And I caught myself in that, like a new hunter who has never seen and never tracked a deer and is just like eyes up. Yep. And it's so hard to get that balance when you're the only one out there. Cause I think this is the first year I've had to track alone. Definitely one of the first years I've done alone. Like even the deer.
Other than my buck that I shot at dead nuts.
That's true. Tracked. But again, but I didn't shoot take it, that
right.
One. So that one adrenaline. I was tracking blood, and I was mad you didn't let it get to me.
It was never going to come to
it
you.
It was coming right for me.
It was going to wind me, and I took it.
So there was kind of that neat recognition of I'm Boomer the Bloodhound, as you say, and I'm trying to keep my head down and keep into that mindset, but I'm also looking up knowing I got a good hit. Like there's no way she kept running. I mean, it was 100-150 yards. I mean, it was almost across the field. Yeah. I couldn't believe how far she ran on that. And it was a clean double lung.
Yeah.
It was a little bit lower. So I would have expected the blood to kind of pour out a little bit more than it did. I know sometimes if you hit high, it fills up the cavity, but this wasn't that. And I was just not getting a ton of blood, especially as I was getting closer to her, there was a lot less blood.
Yeah.
So I remember thinking that, like, I'm starting to lose a trail here outside the tracks. And then I looked up and there was a brown mound just after I crested that hill. And so that was, I think I texted, praise God.
Praise
like
God.
I got a deer and put on lard and onions. Yep. I think that's how that went.
And you know, it's, that buck that I shot with the bow that we tracked for like 3 hours all over the place. And that was a single lung. It's, lung shots, they go. You know, everybody says, well, you want to hit the heart or the lungs. Well, they'll die from that usually, but it's with a lung shot, they go a lot further than you think.
Yeah.
And the reality is, with that buck, if we had not kept pushing it,
I agree. I think
don't
that
think we would have gotten them. So
yeah.
And then muzzleloader in general, I've had a lot of muzzleloader kills that have left no blood trail. Mm. I got one when we were hunting down in Steuben County. I was on a tree stand, and this thing was like 110 yards downhill into this ravine. And I shot, and the thing took off. I'm like, that's money, because my muzzleloaders were dead on.
Yeah.
So I get down and I go, there's not a drop of blood. There's fresh track in the snow, but not a drop of blood. I'm like, I'm going to follow this because I know I hit this thing. Mm-hmm. There was never a drop of blood, and I came to it with a dead deer.
Really?
Never a drop of blood.
That's crazy.
And the other thing is, too, is that
they don't always pass through.
They don't pass through, which is good. I mean, good and bad. So the good is that all of the energy gets dumped in the deer.
Well, that's my last muzzleloader deer dropped right in its tracks.
Right. The bad is you don't get the blood trail. You don't get the exit wound.
Yep.
So, well, that's cool. Congratulations.
Yeah. Kept my streak alive.
Yeah. And Jake shot one. It just wasn't fit for consumption. And Emily got one. First day of bow season.
First buck with a bow. First bow.
And
Kim got one.
Kim got one. And then I got...
Fiance Jake got
two, I think.
He got
two doe. Yep. So I felt bad for Ryan Martin, and I talked to him a little bit about it and said, I've been hunting for you the last week, and then I said, but I, you know, then I got thinking, would I want somebody to give me a deer? Because that's exactly right. I don't want your stinking deer.
Because it, it's know, almost salt in the wounds. Like, yeah, I got a deer.
That's right.
You know, you can't get one, but I can. I can get two. Yep.
I'm not man enough to get a deer. So, but it was, you know, it was just a, it was a weird season. Nobody, I mean, my buck was 2.5, wasn't huge. It's funny cause, Matt Ross from the NDA messaged me today. He said, "Hey Mike, do you want to send in any teeth again this year?" I said, "No, we know every deer we got is in the 2.5 year to maybe 3.5 year. I haven't looked at the jawbone of your doe.
I haven't, but judging by the doe, my guess is 2.5.
Did you pull the jaw or did you? No. Yeah.
No, because I was pretty confident it was 2.5.
Well, and based on the weight too.
Yeah. So that was only a 100-pound doe.
Yeah.
Which.
So.
I didn't have the antlers like yours weighing it down.
Yeah, my buck, that tells you all you need to know. It was only like 142 or 148 pounds, something like that. It wasn't a huge.
Was that the one with antlers? Mm-hmm. I was talking about the one with the little antlers.
Shut up. Well, and I think JD took 2 doe this year too. Mm. So
yeah. Someone sent me, I think Chris Walker sent me, who, by the way, we're end of the season. You guys that got bucks and are looking to get Euro mounts, Chris Walker's in the Wyoming County. Actually, he might be Cattaraugus.
Or Allegheny.
Allegheny,
County.
Yeah.
County. What's this town that he's in?
Like Almond, Alfred, yeah, and Andover, Allegheny. Somewhere's in that.
Yep.
He does Euro mounts and he'll do, and going into turkey season, spring turkey, he does turkey mounts as well.
And he's really reasonable.
Yeah, I think it's 40 or 50 for the Euro, and then it's an additional. It ranges for the mount itself, want the plaque.
Yeah, so. I keep looking at mine out there thinking,
I don't really want to do this.
I don't feel like doing it.
I really don't want to do Emily's.
I've got the skin off. Well, Emily's now, it's frozen. All you got to do is throw it in the pot. And
does it still smell as bad as it did?
Well, not if it's frozen, usually. Yeah. And I haven't even looked. Is it a skull plate or is it an actual Euro?
For hers?
Yeah.
Is it the whole head? The whole head is in there, but I don't know. If all she wants is a skull plate, I can do that.
No, I think she wanted the full.
I was thinking she did as well. Yeah. I was thinking about that for my doll. Maybe I'd do it. Send that into
do a Euro. Yeah. So yeah, I need to probably get the pot or the boiler out. Yeah.
Anyway, Chris sent me a post a little while ago, and it was of a midget deer taken. I think it may be Alabama. Mm-hmm. So it was judged at like 3.5 or 4.5, but it was like 70 pounds.
Was it the guy holding it up? Like
it's a
black, looks like a blacker.
Yeah, black. Yeah.
Yep.
Like it looks the size of an Angus, like a dog. Yeah. Although Angus is small.
I think the proper term was dwarf deer.
Dwarf deer. I don't know. All I know is I was making the joke that, my little dinky 2.5-year-old or 1.5-year-old basket buck I took a couple of years ago wasn't actually a 1.5. He was 4.5. He was just a dwarf. So,
yeah. So yeah, it was a good season, but it was bizarre.
I know. I was getting real pumped up by the end of the summer. We had pictures. We actually had some bigger deer that were and bucks especially.
Yep.
Some decent sign that they were on our property, and then
yeah.
Especially come rifle season, they vanished. Early bow was promising. We were seeing some stuff. I was seeing a lot of the younger bucks, and we knew the older bucks were just coming out late. So I was kind of waiting for that turn, and then it just never happened. So
that
was...
Yeah, and I've had 2 encounters with that wide 5 that I tried to spook your way.
Yeah,
I had him come down to Trump Tower, and I had him come to the north edge stand.
I think that wide 5 is the one that I drew on in the double wide, but was kind of at a weird angle to take, and it never came in that close.
Yeah.
And I was still on the edge of when I was going to take, like that, in that double wide, he gave me a long time to think about taking him.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until later that I drew, because originally he didn't look that big.
And I think he's 2.5.
Yeah. I think I'm glad I waited than trying to rush a shot or.
But I haven't seen him since. He hasn't shown up on camera since. Well, there's a 6 and a 7 that have shown up, but they're 2.5-year-olds too. So.
Well, they'll be 3.5 next year.
Right. Right.
So.
The saddest part of the season was losing the tall 6 to a car. Yeah. That was frustrating.
We didn't even get the wreck.
No. So Amish, if you're listening, you better get that thing mounted. So what it does do, though, is being in the stand as much as we were, at least for me, I spend a lot of time looking at the habitat work we've done already on the property, how it's impacted deer movement. Mm-hmm. My experiences have been having, you know, had a number, been a part of a number of deer properties, you know, like mm-hmm. At my cousin's, at Delaps, at Dead Nuts, in Cattaraugus when we hunted the farm. Like having those experiences, it takes 5 to 7 years to really figure out a property. Like Uncle Jay and I had that. I mean, we had this boomerang effect. So he'd be in the pines and I'd be in the yote stand, and he would shoot. Those deer would drop right down to Davis Creek, come right up to me, and I'd shoot, and then they'd go right back to him. It takes time to figure out the patterns and how deer move.
Yeah, and especially when you're considering they're moving different throughout the year.
Yeah. Yep. So I feel like we've figured that out, and we're figuring out how the habitat changes or improvements mm-hmm. that we've made are adjusting their movements.
Yeah.
Right. So we built the cabin, and we purchased the land in 2008, built the cabin or 2018. That summer was largely building.
Yeah.
And then after that, we were full on with projects. So we've done a significant amount of TSI, which if they were on a broader scale would be close to clear cuts, some of them.
Yeah. If they weren't, I mean, what they are in a sense are clear cuts. I think size-wise, they just don't meet the requirement.
Right.
But that's just what our property is. It's what we're going to do.
Yeah, so we should probably back up and give a picture of our property. So mm-hmm. our property is 20 acres in a rectangle, basically, that has a gas cut that goes through it that we're allowed to plant. We put that in food plots. Mm-hmm. And then an additional 13 acres to the east of us that butts up to us that's also part of that rectangle that we've been given full permission to do whatever we want with, cut trees, put ponds in, food plots, whatever we want. Beyond that, we have, I think it's like 8 acres that we have permission to hunt, which is, but we don't have permission to manage. And then to the west, we've got another 13 acres that we have sole permission for, but we can't manage that either. Mm. So we've kind of got this, our 20 and then the next block, which is, and I'm not using names, that next block of 13 or 14.
Yep.
So really like 34 acres. And that block of 34 is a rectangle.
Yeah. And it's landlocked by ag. Mm-hmm. And that varies, and that affects our hunting seasons a lot, whether it's corn or alfalfa or soybean. And then even it depends on whether or not. So this year, a lot of it got turned over. And I think that played a big role in what was we weren't seeing deer, because it got turned over and they weren't being able to hit that ag. They were going elsewhere.
Right. And they left the deer. It's funny. You talk to hunters, and maybe it's because you're biased because of what you experience, and then they're echoing that. Mm-hmm. You know, so maybe if I was saying, oh, I had a great year, I would only hear the people that are saying we had a great year. But everybody I'm talking to is like, the deer just disappeared. Like they were there one day and they're gone the next. Like they just vanished. And that's what I'm hearing from JD, from Ryan, from Uncle Steve talked a little bit about that. Like there's I've had numerous people. I think even John Goodwin was saying the same thing. They just disappeared for a while. And I wondered if that was because of a mass drop. You know, was it a good mass drop year? Mm-hmm. It's hard to tell since we've only got red oaks, and they're more like on a 5-year rotation.
Right.
But the deer were just gone. We had almost 2 weeks without even doe on camera. Yeah. And then they turned over the ag. And so now not only do we not have the mass, we didn't have the ag
either. Right.
So anyway, we have this property that we manage, and we did a management plan 6 years ago and said, okay, we we've got all this ag, so their food isn't an issue. What's going to make us stand out? Well, we want to create good fawning cover, good bedding cover for adult deer, and we want to probably be able to provide some thermal cover, yep, you know, with pines or cedar or whatever.
Yeah.
And we've set about to do that. Like, we've accomplished some of those goals.
Right. I mean, we've done one cut that we do primarily, and we've kind of left it.
Yep.
That first initial cut on the east side, west?
North.
East side, on the east side, that east cut, past the gas cut.
Yep, by those.
So that one we cut, that was one of the first ones we cut.
Yep.
And we've really kind of let that go, and we're starting to see some thicker early successional growth starting to come in there. It's not just brush.
Right.
With that west cut that we did 2 years ago now, I think, our intent is really kind of leaving that and trying to keep it at that brushy early success, not really hard woody, you know, soft grasslands. And it's a little wetter.
Yep.
So we did plant some tamaracks in there to see if we could get that to go. I don't know how well.
I haven't found them.
It's so thick in there.
But we did find, we did put in, I think, 6 white pine, and 4 of them are doing really well.
Yep.
And then we have some sumac in there that's all rubbed.
Like
every one of them's got a rub on it.
And so some of that is really just establishing biodiversity. We have no evergreens on our property whatsoever.
None.
We've got a couple of patches that are pretty much solely beech, which is common with beech, where you'll get a patch where they root sprouts that are just unreal, especially as you're getting older trees that are dying. They just send up shoots like nobody's business. So we've got areas that are pretty much solely that. We've got a couple of areas that are primarily maple with the occasional oak or hickory mixed in there. And so, especially when we first got here, that was the composition. It was pockets of beech, thick beech, and then a hickory maple, a little bit of an oak, a little bit of a cottonwood, older stand that was probably in the 60-year-old. And single aged. There was nothing in the bottom area. There was no early growth. There was no vegetation on the ground.
Yep.
And we've seen a lot of that change, especially these cuts that we've done. And you can really see it with the one that we did most recent, adding on to the food plot.
Yep.
Where we planted some apple trees in there as well.
Yeah. Dalgo crab apples.
All along the edges of that is getting sunlight that never did. And all that seed bed you can see is just shooting up. And some of that, I think we did a good job when we did the logging to pull those out. We scarified a lot of soil that were exposing plants that
have been
the spice bush that we never saw. There wasn't any spice bush on this property 5 years ago. And we're getting it growing, and we didn't plant that.
Yep.
That is the seed bed that is just, they've lasted for however many years, and we're finally seeing that grow, which is cool.
And the other thing that did was it opened the angle for the sun, because that rectangle goes east and west, so it's opened the angle for the sun to hit the food plot, which has allowed that corn to grow much better this year, too.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And that plot that we cut was really designed to create a place for woody browse.
Yeah.
And hopefully those apple trees will come up. Mm. And I kind of have some thoughts for, so there's a wooded area that I thinned between that cut and the first cut we did.
Yes. I took a big, probably my biggest takeaway of the season. And I think that's, is that plot forced funnels. It forced the deer to be funneled either on in between that and the field on the north side, or that in the field on the south side. And especially looking archery season, you can get within range where the deer are either going to be right there and you're going to get them on your side, or they're going to be on the other side and you can have somebody hunting on the other side.
Yeah.
Or you can do it where you're playing the wind.
Yeah.
And that's something I've done a lot, is we've got stands on either side, which sometimes I feel like, those stands are really close. We really need them that close. But then when you get into the season and you've got a weird wind and you can go to one but not the other, I took advantage of that a lot this season.
Yeah, and I almost never hunt that north side. Like the night that I shot that buck 2 years ago, I think, was there. And that was on the north side, and it was just a flyer. I'm like, I was upset about some stuff going on in life, and I'm thinking, I'm going to go sit somewhere Jackie, mom said, you know, go out and hunt. I don't want to. I'll just go be out there and settle down. So I just picked a stand. I figured I'm not going to ruin anybody's hunt. And that buck just showed up. So I almost never hunt that front side.
Which we have seen success a couple years before in that, when you were in that hangar stand and you took one later season. I know there was snow on the ground for that.
Yep.
I don't remember if that one, I kind of feel like that didn't get recovered. That was one of the ones.
No, it didn't get recovered.
But then this
well,
season,
actually the deadhead is hanging in the...
it got recovered just a little too late.
Yeah.
Which is always, that's almost worse than it just not getting recovered. Yep. Really.
Yeah.
It hurts. But this season I sat in that, one of the only times I sat in that stand, partly because it was not the most comfortable stand to sit in, to be honest.
Yeah.
I didn't see anything all hunt, and I was getting down, like I was letting my bow down because a light had passed, and there was decent size. I think it was a tall six.
Yeah.
Not positive, but I
probably
I only saw him for like a split couple seconds, and then I saw his tail as I'm letting my bow down. But there were deer running that side, and I don't think they necessarily were so much previous to that cut because it forced them to the side. Whereas like my big buck that I took 2 or 3 years ago now was right in the middle of the woods because he could. He was not in danger of being on the edge of a field where something was going to spot him. It's wide open. He was in the middle. He was just kind of, and he was just using it to run. I mean, he was hot on a doe or something. He was nose to the ground and he was hauling. But he took that middle. And now that we've established some bedding in there, they still go in there. But when their average movements, if they're going from like the food plot to the far side of that property, they're on those edges where we can set up now. We could set up on the edge of the field where we can get a shot to the field and we can get a shot inside the woods, which we couldn't before.
And they've got established trails on both the north side and the south side.
Yep. All right. Well, now that I've kind of shared mine, let me ask you, what's your biggest takeaway property wise of the season?
Yeah. So I mentioned earlier that, you know, a lot of my time sitting in the stands I've spent, and maybe this is because I'm getting old, like looking and saying, oh, this has worked. We could tweak it if we took down those three trees, or we could do this and you know, get them to move this direction a little more. Or, but I think the biggest eye opener for me, which is funny because we write management plans, like this should be second nature to me, but I was seeing it, you know, with my own eyes was, so when we got permission to manage that additional acreage to the east of us, I went in and just did what I call like a blowdown cut. I cut down a bunch of trees, I hinged some, and just created this mess where deer would bed. And I thought, oh, that's, you know, that, let's see if that works. Well, sure enough, I would, especially on the north side, I'd slip into that stand. I'd see deer there just about every time. Mm-hmm. And that's not the part that I should have realized, because of course they're going to bed. They're going to bed where they've got cover. They're going to bed where there's fresh forbs or fresh
buds
on the ground that they can eat. What got me was the idea that that bedding swath, or that blowdown swath, didn't only provide bedding, but it pushed the deer to the north or to the south edge, we were talking about. And it really did, because it's so thick in there. And originally when I cut them, I'm like, oh, maybe I should cut some trails in here that'll allow the deer to move better. But I think it worked better this way because it pushed them to the outer edges where we could get shots.
Yeah, for just their average travel.
Yeah. So then the second thing that hit me was, so from the cut that we did along the food plot to the cut that I did, that blowdown cut, maybe 100 yards, maybe 75 yards, I don't know. And in that area, there's probably 50 yards of open woods. Mm-hmm. Mature, I don't know if you want to really call them mature, but mature for here, 80-year-old woods, something like that. They're all, I don't know, what would you say? That's a 16, 18 inch DBH.
Yeah, I would say the average in there is probably 16 to 18.
And the thought hit me, and maybe it's just an experiment, was what if we kept 50 yards like that, and then we did a little bit more finessing with the blowdown cut, and then further east, we do another 50 yards like mm-hmm. that, and then do another blowdown cut.
Yeah.
So that we're leaving that open hardwoods for rutting activity, you know, so they're chasing or moving.
Yep.
But we're also providing that cover and that blowdown
stuff.
And then it makes the stands more viable that are down further east on those outside edges. It'll cause the same kind of pattern.
Right.
Like where the tent is, deer rarely cross that there because they like Killer's Ridge.
Yeah.
And I don't even know what to do with Killer's Ridge.
No. And that's a whole nother animal to
and it's tackle. If you're listening to this, so Killer's Ridge is this tiny, tiny ridge.
Whenever I think ridge, I'm thinking like at Dead Nuts.
Yeah, and this is like a speed bump. Emily would be like, that's not a ridge.
It's like what I think, and you've mentioned that, is it was probably like an old homestead or barn or something.
Yeah, there's all kinds of like bottles and
axles and barb fence. So I'm sure that's, but
we've shot a lot of deer up there.
And or they've died there.
Right. And so that ridge, quote unquote, is full of beech. Had to have been cut probably, I don't know, 10 years ago because there was the beech whips were so thick in there when we first got here. Now they've matured and thinned out.
And they're just high enough where like the thick leaves is above the head of the deer. Yeah, and I think that's playing a role.
I'm wondering if we need to go back in there and set it back again. Mm-hmm. Like how do we cut those down? Do we cut some more beech trees out of there?
Well, and beech are unique because it doesn't take much to establish beech whips
because
of their shoot sprouting.
Right.
So
right.
you can girdle and spray like a mature beech, and it knows it's dying, and it'll sense a hormone or a sensor or there's it's
pretty
not
sure a, it's not a hormone.
It's not a hormone, but it's like a hormone. It's a chemical, and I don't there is a term for it.
Yeah.
But it sends a chemical through the system that hey, we're dying. We need to start spreading new trees to continue our DNA essentially.
Yep.
Which is wild to think about in trees. You know, you think of them basically as rocks, like they're inanimate objects, but they're really, their root systems communicate. And my old professor, an ecology professor, would be ecstatic to hear me talking about mycorrhiza and how they communicate and their roots touch. And it is interesting, especially with trees like beech. And so like the largest living organism isn't like a whale or anything. It's a group of aspen in Alaska.
Aspen though. It might be the redwoods, right?
No, I'd have to double check, but I'm almost positive it's aspen.
Okay.
In fact, I'll look it up because I don't want to be spreading false information here.
So
look it up, Jamie.
So the piece that goes along with that too, right, is before you start cutting beech spray. Like kill them because that'll avoid. So this year when we did that cut, we had all kinds of beech whips coming up, and I went, and all I had with me at the time was glyphosate, and so I sprayed them. They all died, which I couldn't believe. I thought I was going to have to use like Craig Harper, Dr. Harper's cocktail, and I didn't want to because some of that is ground active, I was able to just do a full foliar spray and kill them. But.
Yeah, glyphosate is an interesting one. Like, it doesn't affect maples. I don't know if you
I haven't
noticed that.
Yeah.
Just like on the side, it doesn't affect maples.
Well, it took out the beech, which is what I wanted.
Well, and so beech, in forestry terms, when we're looking at beech for that, we don't really want it.
Right.
It's kind of a crappy wood, especially when it's not growing well. Yeah. It doesn't grow straight. If it was growing straight, it's a pretty solid, hard wood. It's a heavy wood. It's dense.
Yeah. There's a log that's burning here that's been in there probably an hour now.
Right. It just kind of smolders.
Yeah, exactly.
but it shoots up those sprouts that just cover all of the maples and stuff that you're trying to get to grow up.
Right.
And so what you need to do is you need to do it at the end of the winter. And you need to cut at the end of the winter, beginning of spring.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't have any energy from it's all their reserves from the winter.
Sure.
So they send out all their spray, their shoots and stuff, shoots up in the spring, and you get all this life, and then you kill those back.
Yeah.
And then what happens is there's no more energy reserved in the roots because it's already used it once.
Right.
And then in theory, you're at least going to get less coming back.
Which is interesting too, right? Because they say about the only time a year when girdle and spray or hack and squirt doesn't work is in when the sap's running,
right?
Because it'll dilute it. So you, right. Yeah,
which yep. is, you know, and it's that's the combat of forestry.
There's, right, right.
It's not just cutting trees.
No.
So I did look it up. Pando populus pando. Okay. It's called Pando the tree, and it's Pando populus. Populus is mm-hmm. the poplar family, which aspen are part of. It's a one tree aspen forest in Utah, made up of over 47,000 trunks and millions of leaves connected wow. through one root system, and is the largest organism on Earth.
Wow.
So
that's wild. And you know, there's, and I don't know what species of willow, but there's a willow tree, which is really a weed, that listens for water, and it'll send its roots to water.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. So and that stuff is always fascinating to me, mm-hmm. like species like that reach out.
Yeah.
But there was a study done where, and I don't remember what tree species specifically it was, but it could notice the root systems of its own offspring. Mm-hmm. So if it was a oak tree, for example, and it dropped acorns, and it knew its tree's acorns rather than a tree neighboring.
Would it matter if it's Acer root? Well,
Acer's maple.
Well, so then it would matter.
It definitely would matter.
What's my oak?
Red oak, white oak. Quercus.
Yes, Quercus.
Quercus that's alba what it was. Versus
yes.
Quercus rubra?
You've been out of school less than a year, boy.
Quercus rubra.
I've got 30 years.
Hopefully, Emily's not looking at this.
I'm okay talking about Phagus grandifolia.
Anyway, the mother tree or parent tree could recognize the root systems of their own tree,
wow.
and pull their roots back to allow room for growth and allow extra water intake from their offspring.
Wow,
which is a crazy thing to even think about of trees.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's just...
Which is all comes back to me in terms of, and this is a little bit of a controversial topic, but I don't care. These guys that are planting miscanthus and thinking, okay, we're gonna plant these rhizomes. They've been neutered, mm-hmm. And we're gonna use this as screening. But the neutered process, it means it's only like 80% neutered.
Yep.
So you're still getting, you're introducing a non-native,
yep.
and it's going to spread despite what they're telling you.
Well, and here's my issue with that, is it isn't so much that it's going to spread. Because, so we have, and I was just having a conversation with somebody at work about this, of the difference between non-natives and invasives. Because we have non-natives that... They're now naturally right. They're just a part of our
like
ecosystem.
Corn. Corn is a non-native,
right. But it's but just
not invasive.
A part of what we have. It's something that we see regularly.
Right.
We have a lot of things along those lines. My issue with that is, if I'm going to provide cover for deer, why wouldn't I use something that they're used to?
Right.
Which this is an interesting one. We don't really see beech as a good cover for them. Mm-hmm. But the deer that we have around our property are so used to beech because it's a native. It's something that, as a result of cutting, of blowdowns, of fire, of properties that are left to grow, meadows that are left to grow, you get beech whips.
Yeah.
And it's something that they're used to and that they're accustomed to.
And we've spent a lot of years going around, oh, we got to kill the beech, we got to kill the beech. It's good, but it's not best.
Mm-hmm.
And this year, I kind of came to the conclusion of, why aren't we using this to our advantage?
Right. Well, and we saw that with Killer's Ridge, which was a thick beech whip that we knew wasn't great.
Yep.
And so we went, and on our property, we cut these cuts, and we were like, okay, this is going to be much better than the beech. They're going to come to our property over the beach, and for whatever reason, they stayed at the beach. And I think, and now we're getting them in a lot of our cut, but I think some of that is they're used to this beach.
Yeah.
I think also maybe they just like looking at the boogie woogies on the branches during the summer, but that could just be me.
I saw my first ones this year, and those are an invasive as well. They're not.
Well, and they're technically a parasite, but they don't really damage the beech tree.
Yeah. Yep. So we avoid miscanthus like the plague. Okay, so what do we use? Well, you can use switchgrass. There's native mm-hmm. switchgrasses you can use. We've had. What was the reed canary grass or whatever, canary reed grass, whatever it was that we had here that I killed off because that stuff just grows. It was, you know, all over the food plot and stuff. Mm-hmm. Or what we used this year, which I think worked well, was corn. Right? Yeah. I mean, it provided food. We got to kill some coons, but it provided food and it definitely provided cover and breakup. So even though the ag field to the north, ag field to the south are going to be corn this year, I'll still probably do one more year of that breakup.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing is they're corn to the north and south until they cut it.
Yeah. Yep.
So.
Absolutely. And so, and that leads us into a whole nother discussion about what did we learn about the food plot this year and what do we, and I talked a little bit about this on the year end review, mm-hmm. But have had some feedback, some good feedback from like Nate St. James said, well, how about put if the deer are mowing down the beans, obviously that's a hot ticket, the soybeans that are planted. You could put a hot fence around it. Or, and I planted those in August, but they struggled to come up for a while. But they're Roundup ready, so plant them in August, then hit them once with glyphosate. And did I say that right? I did. And then in between rows, plant brassicas, you know, so that there's something there, because right now it's bare soil, which in the spring that'll be fine for a turkey. But I hate leaving soil bare for any amount of time. The one thing that we have planted that the deer have just consistently hit year after year, no matter what time of the year, has been clover. And to plant a mix of three or four different types of clover. Hitless seed is who we usually use. A Ladino, a red, crimson mix of clovers. And their seed mix, we're not sponsored by them at all, but their seed mix has been fantastic. And then the other thing we have done, and I'm going to move where I do it this year, is a summer blend so that we're feeding during the time that they're putting on antlers and the lactation time. Those are the two that we want to provide food during those times. Because a deer's diet shifts anyway in the fall, in the winter. They're going to be, browse becomes 90% of their diet at that point. So, and then also, and this is not something that most hunters think about, is the pollinators. You know, so we always do creative habitat seed for pollinator blends, which, you know, brings in more bees, brings in butterflies and all that stuff, you know, songbirds, that kind of thing. And
I would love to do some bee like cultivating, I think it'd be cool to get your own honey.
Yeah.
And maybe that's just cause I like the homesteading aspect that we do our own maple syrup with, you know, I think it'd be cool to do our own honey.
Well, and FJ's dad does them.
Yeah. So. And I've talked to some other people that do them. I mean, I think we have enough property that we could put them out far enough away from the cabin that they wouldn't be affecting us like during the summer. And the reality is I think honeybees in general tend to be more docile species than others.
Yeah.
I don't know if I feel like spending money on getting a bee suit. I'd probably be out there like in my chaps in a Carhartt coat in the middle of the summer and some heavy gloves hoping for the best.
Yeah, you know? You're supposed to smoke them. You'll be out there with a cigar.
I'd use my drip torch to make sure that.
Yeah, that brings up a whole nother ball, right? Like we've got some cuts that we're
trying to keep.
If we don't set them back, we're going to end up having to go back through with a chainsaw.
Right, and that's...
And stinking New York. You got one fire boss, and they're down in, like, Manhattan or something. And you can't burn March 31st to May 31st or something screwy like that. I forget the dates.
Right, which is really the ideal time for a prescribed burn.
Right,
because it's just before new growth is setting in. The plants, especially like the 1 hour plants, will be dry during the day, which for people that don't know, fires, wood and fuel is separated into different groups based on how long it takes for them to be dry enough to burn. So you get 1 hour fuels, which is like your switchgrass and your shrubby leafy plants. And then you get, I think it's like, it goes up to like 12 hour or 10 hour, which are some of like the smaller twigs and woody debris and bushes and stuff. And then it goes up to like your 24 hour or your multiple days,
yeah.
which is larger trees and stuff that, that take a little bit more time to dry after like a heavy rain before they, yeah. they're ready to be lit on fire. But that time of year, we're getting some rain. The ground can be wet around, mm-hmm. and it takes an hour for that grass to dry. You dig a line, you burn in layers, yep. and it, with proper technique, it's really a really useful tool. The issue is there are a lot of people that, oh, all I got to do is set this pasture yeah. on fire and yeah. it'll be great. Or you're not telling people and all of a sudden you see this cloud of smoke and somebody's yep. calling the cops because they think your cabin's on fire. And
that's why if you were going to do it, you do it at night. But the other piece to that too is you get the opposite, right, where people think, you know, Smokey the Bear was the worst thing to ever happen to habitat management. Like, oh no, fire bad, fire mm-hmm. evil. We gotta, no, most of this stuff needs yep. to be set back using fire. Yep. And instead we're putting chemical on it, you know, glyphosate, the whole thing to kill it off. So then we can start, you know, over. Well, that's not any healthier mm-hmm. than what a normal disturbance would be, which would be fire. You know, so.
Well, and it's interesting working with people with like working within the state now. I've talked to a lot of people that are of this newer generation that may have, when they were younger, known about Smokey the Bear, but the science behind how beneficial fires have been is really only coming in the last 20, maybe 30 years.
Yeah.
Like the 90s is when that first kind of peaked. 80s, there was some push for it, but it was kind of like this. It was a touchy subject, and now it's starting to become more and more accepted, especially as you move towards out west, where we know the reason that we had such terrible fires in the 50s and then 60s time frame is because we didn't let fires burn in the first place.
Right, it's unmanaged.
So then they got to this, we're going to let it burn, but we won't set them. But right. if they're natural, we'll let them burn. And now we're getting to a point where we know.
What's the hour rule like that? 24-hour rule or something like that.
It was so before there was a 10-hour. We needed to have this whole fire out
yeah.
in 10 hours.
Yeah.
And obviously, and some of that was that was coming after World War II, where we had paratroopers that transitioned to airdrop, and they were hot shots that were yeah. they were yeah. jumping into fires, and so there was a big push on that we're going to get these fires under control right away, and so nothing was getting burned.
Yeah.
And we started to learn that lesson pretty quick when we were having some devastating fires yeah. There was a lot of loss and they were just uncontrolled. When we set in the let burn policy that helped.
Yeah.
But
the Adirondacks don't have that.
No.
And I think they're setting themselves up for a disaster.
And I agree, being up there, working in state parks, yeah. I've seen a lot of that.
Yep.
It's surprisingly not as bad in a lot of the parks. Working in a lot of campgrounds and stuff like that, because if you've ever camped, 90% of the time you're starting a fire. You might bring some of your own logs, but you'll scavenge mm-hmm. wood.
Yeah.
And it's funny, you can see a clear difference if you're walking in the woods at any of the state parks from where you're walking in the woods to when you're walking near a campsite, because yeah. every piece of wood that is on the ground that could be burnt has been burnt by campers and little Timmy right. that's running off making fire sticks.
The difference in the Adirondacks, though, is duff, right? You yeah. have all that.
Well, that's all their soil is. It's yeah. 10 inches of duff and then some rock.
And you'll get fire, underground fires that'll yep, burn that for are days running.
Yeah. And that's, we've seen that a lot in the Catskills, actually.
Yeah. yeah.
Where they've had, I was speaking to a forest ranger when I was at ranger school, that they had a fire that they put out, and they were walking around with, and I am going to blank on the new PC technical term, or what they were always called was Indian bags, because mm-hmm. Indian made them.
Yeah.
But we don't call them Indian bags because
no, of course it's, not. Being Native American myself, go ahead and call it.
They are water backpacks that yeah, you can yeah. pump and you can hike out miles. And so they take those out and spit on, you know, little spots of fire. And they did that, and they were just making sure everything was good. They called it a night or whatever. Come back. Well, that fire had been smoldering underneath all these layers of duff and revamped and came back to life. And we're seeing that more and more. And I think the Adirondacks are out of touch
yeah.
because we are a boreal forest. And yep. our forest type is not meant to have fires outside every 100 to 150 years.
Right.
Especially as you move up towards Canada. Canada, you might get a fire every once in 150 years, 500 years. That's their cycle. Yeah. That is the fire cycle that they have up there. It's every 500 years we're going to get a, but it is a everything is burnt fire.
Yeah.
Whereas Alabama, Alabama, you're going to get a fire every year or every 2 years.
Yep.
And it's just on the prairie. You're just burning the sage grass, and it's and that's all it is.
Yeah.
But up in the Adirondacks and into Canada, you're not going to get them that frequently, but it's going to be bad. And we have not had a real good fire since probably the 40s, 50s, when we had trains running in the Adirondacks.
Yeah, when we started pulling guys out of the fire towers. And I just read something recently about a fire in the town of Fine in Santa Clara. Major fire, and they, you know, it's been years since.
Yeah, we're almost to like a 100-year mark when we were really into that.
Yeah,
you know, when the fire tower got moved to the Ranger School was in, I think, the 40s or 50s.
Yeah,
and that's a crazy story on its own, that they carried this fire tower up to the top of Cathedral Rock, and that's cool on its own, but. It's just that culture kind of changed a little bit. And it's now the fire towers are used for nothing. Then you can get a patch if you hike them all.
Right, exactly.
And this is my marking the words. This is my Simpsons claimed it all, guessed it all. Everything that's going to happen is that we're going to get a fire within the next probably 20 years, I'll bet you. That is going to be big in the Adirondacks, and it's going to burn a lot of old wood.
Yep. Yep,
because that's just the way the natural works go, and I think people either it's going to open some eyes to fire's natural, or there is going to be some panic, and there is going to be some drive for the fact that the Adirondacks weren't properly managed, and hopefully that instills some change into more than just letting everything just go. Because
so there's a guy that I follow on Instagram because was friends with Emily, and I think he graduated before Emily from Wanakina, Rob Van Leesout, and he's out west, and he's posted somewhere that he had just got a new job as a burn boss, basically, out west, and we've had some different discussions back and forth that, you know, about the need to burn, you know, the need for prescribed burns, so that what you're doing is you're managing instead of having a major burnover, like, you know, what we see out west, you're setting those, you're burning off that fuel. So you're not getting those major burns. We've talked about fire before. We talked about, if you get a chance, if you read Norman MacLean's A River Runs Through It, he's also done two short stories along, you know, from his time with the Forest Service. He talks about, did a great book on the Man Gulch fire. Mm-hmm. And then his son did one that I think was probably an assigned reading for you with Ranger School. And it was, I read it, Emily gave it to me. Maybe it was for Ranger School, or maybe it was for ESF. And it was a good treatment of it.
Do you remember what it was called?
I don't, but it was dry. another great one is The Big Burn. And it looks at the political side of it with Gifford Pinchot and Teddy Roosevelt and the fires, you know. And it talks specifically about Man Gulch, which really Man Gulch is the fire that kind of changed the way that we do a lot of the stuff that we do.
Yeah, for sure.
And I know we've talked about this before because we've talked about the song.
Yeah, and we've talked a lot about fire before.
Yeah,
we get off topic easily.
We got way off topic, especially considering we can't really have a fire theoretically.
Right. Here. Yeah.
But we need to.
We're passionate about it. That's all it is. It's passion. The burning passion.
Yes. Fire. I love fire.
Yeah. I think that's just because we're guys, and as a very young kid, I was always putting a stick in a fire and then running around with a smoldering stick, getting yelled at. Anything goes in the fire stays in the fire.
We started a fire one time when I was a kid. So we should probably close up on this.
Is that the one in your garage?
No, this was out in the woods. We had tree forts and stuff out in the woods, and we found this like spot where these kids were hanging out, and they had this It wasn't like a regular mattress. It was like a foam kind of thing. And it
like
was just
a memory foam kind of deal.
Yeah. Or? But it was, you know, it's just this foam and it was wet. And then we found these Playboy magazines and being righteous boys that we were like, we should just burn these. So we set them on fire and then we put this wet mattress over it thinking, well, it'll burn itself out. And then we go and play in the woods and we were probably 12 or 14. We come back and that whole mattress is engulfed. There's trees engulfed and I'm peeing on this thing. I'd never peed so much. Joe Marr's running back to his house. He's grabbing buckets of water. The bucket's got a hole in it. So by the time he came back, it was leaking. I mean, we were shoveling stuff. We could not get the thing out. Finally, we just thought, okay, we got to go home. Somebody called it in. The fire trucks are out there. I don't know what happened. I don't know how that happened.
It must have been lightning or something.
But ever since then, I had a healthy respect for fire because I couldn't believe how quickly that thing got out of control. So.
Yeah.
But one last thing about fire, too, is that it's great for burning off that, you know, those... The native growth things like ragweed and I'm trying to think of the others that are in there, that category. And I want to what's the hay fever stuff that sets me off all the time? It's ragweed and whatever. I don't know. What's the
like
cut
meadow sweet?
Yeah, stuff like that.
Yeah.
So you burn that
early goldenrod.
Goldenrod, that's the one. Yeah. It burn off all that stuff. Great. Well, if you do a prescribed fire later in the summer, it's going to have a different effect on the woody browse. So things like spicewood or red osier dogwood, it's going to impact those things differently than if you have an early spring fire.
If we really want to talk about different impact, that impacts when you're doing it
right.
In terms of year to year.
Yeah.
When you first do a cut and you're getting first establishment, you might be burning some of that the grasses stuff and you're burning that off.
Or leaf litter,
Right. And now you've got woody debris coming up over that.
Yeah.
And there's trees established specifically for that kind of thing that are meant to lay low underneath and then fire comes through and they're good and they can shoot up.
Cool. Well, we've got plans that we're working on that we're going to probably talk about in the coming weeks. We've got some fun interviews. Hopefully, Chris, we can interview Chris about the
I'll have to text him
doing the mounts. I've got the owner of Trophy Tracks I invited him to be on. He wants to be on. We're going to follow up with Pete Rogers from Christian Outdoor Podcast to talk about trapping. I figured you'd want to be on that one.
Yeah, I'll get on that.
We got to cover Kim's deer. We've got a bunch of stuff. And I'm going to be at the Harrisburg show this year for about for most of that week. I'll be there the first Thursday and Friday, and then I'll be back down Tuesday through Friday of that. So I'll be at the catch and release booth. So stop by and see Moosey and myself and anybody else who might be hanging around. And then we've got our Beast Feast coming up in March. So we've got a big banquet in which Pete is going to be joining us here in Perry, and then he's going to do a second night at John Goodwin from Wild Game Freaks at his church. So he'll be up here twice. And so we're looking forward to a lot going on, and there's management stuff kicking in, and then hopefully turkey. We got turkey season.
Turkey.
And I'll say it because I say it every year, April 1st starts trout season. We can get some fly fishing.
I know.
We say it every year.
Last year, I re-kitted my fly rod. Like I got new weighted line. I got new tippet. I kitted it out, and I went. Once?
I don't know.
I went ice fishing for the first time last year.
Yep.
It came up in my memories. I got the only fish that we caught. I think it was about a 4-inch perch, bigger or smaller than some of the bait we were using that we got. It was so funny. I mean, it was a great time, but it was.
And you know, how can I forget this? So Beards Creek Adventures, we're about adventure in the outdoors. Well, it's not just hunting, not just management and fishing, but It's ski season, baby.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we were
going tomorrow to get my new Atomic Ben 85s.
Which all I heard was money, money, money there.
You know, I'm full of it now that I'm working for the state.
Yeah, yeah. Well, enjoy that because eventually the commies will be out of. Well, did I say that?
All right. Time to end the podcast.
All right, folks. Well, thanks for listening and God bless. We'll see you next week.